This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Our program tonight is about the 17th Annual Brower Youth Awards. We are especially welcome, and it's my pleasure to introduce you to Anisha Dazari from Earth Island Institute, and she will speak with you just for a few minutes in a minute. Our moderator tonight is Rosemary Brower Olson, the granddaughter of David Brower. She will introduce our award winners. And so now, Anisha, we'd like to welcome you, and we're so happy that you are here. And please join us now.
Thank you, Anne. Good evening. My name is Anisha Desai, and I'm the program director of the New Leaders Initiative, the youth leadership arm of Earth Island Institute. Earth Island Institute was founded in 1982 by legendary environmentalist David Ross Brower, and it is now an innovative hub that is home to over 70 amazing grassroots and environmental campaigns and projects. A keystone element of Earth Island Institute's year-round New Leaders Initiative is the Brower Youth Awards, and it culminates in an extraordinary and inspiring evening event where 1,000 guests convene to honor and support these remarkable young people. This year's awards ceremony takes place on October 18th, 2016, in San Francisco's War Memorial Building in the Herbst Theater. In our 17 years, the Brower Youth Awards has become the top prize for young environmental leaders in North America, with over 104 activists honored over 17 years, and more than 85% of our Brower Youth Award alumni are still working for environmental and social change. To further introduce this year's winners, I'm happy to welcome to the podium our moderator, Rosemary Brower, granddaughter of David Ross Brower. Welcome, Rosemary.
Hello, my name is Rosemary Brower Olson. I am the granddaughter of David Brower. David was the founder of many environmental organizations, such as Friends of the Earth, which he founded with my grandmother, Ann Brower, Earth Island Institute, and he was also the first executive director of the Sierra Club. He was both an inspiration to and inspired by young people, such as these six winners. And he would be very excited, I think, to see them here and to hear them talk about what inspires and motivates them. Will, would you start by introducing yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Will Amos. I currently work at UC Irvine on a 3D printing and recycling project that's gone on for about a year now.
My name is Erica Davis. I am an environmental activist and law student in Knoxville, Tennessee, and my most recent work includes trying to pass a piece of legislation to reform oil and natural gas severance taxation in the state of Tennessee.
Hi, my name is Heidi Kritz. I'm from Dillingham, Alaska. I am an environmental activist as well. I am currently working for United Tribes of Bristol Bay, a nonprofit consortium working to protect our way of life.
Cool. Hi, everyone. My name is Karina Gonzalez, currently based out of Flagstaff, Arizona, where I do environmental justice organizing work. Right now, currently focused on fossil fuel divestment at Northern Arizona University, as well as doing just transition work on the Navajo Nation.
Hi, I'm Suzette Onate. I'm from Miami, Florida. I work with my high school to restore a butterfly garden and teach the students at my high school about habitat destruction.
Hi, I'm Xerxes Lipsch, a first-year mechanical engineering student at Princeton University. I'm from New York and led a four-year project at Mesquite Farm, which is a rare breed animal farm in Katona, New York.
Great. Thank you, guys. So I think the first part of this panel today is going to be hopefully a discussion between the you guys, and hopefully I can facilitate that. I think my role for tonight is as someone who grew up in a family full of environmentalists and activists, and I care deeply about the planet and about the environment, but I'm also someone who hasn't really had the motivation to actually do something, to actually do something about it. And that's what all six of you have done. And that leads me to my first question, which is, so many of us care about the planet. We're terrified or concerned about what's happening, but we don't really know how to make a difference. I think part of that comes from a lack of sort of confidence in ourselves, or that you are able to make a difference. As Suzette has put it in her application, it's really easy to lose hope and give up. So my question for you guys first is, what force gave you the confidence to believe that you could make a difference and made you act on those feelings? Anyone?
Sure. one of the things that I've learned throughout environmental engineering is that there are a lot of moments where you're going to feel like all the stuff you're working on doesn't really make a difference. And you'll feel these moments of, we worked on this week as a group, the abyss, where we're not really sure where we belong and where we fit in the environmental movement. And so kind of the force that drove me the whole time was seeing kind of fellow environmentalists at the other end of that abyss, having come out of it, but also through my mentorship from Jesse Jackson, our professor that advised our lab. He kind of kept pushing me, and I knew I could kind of build from that to really kind of keep myself motivated the whole time.
Thank you, Will. Anyone else?
Yeah, I would agree. For me, it was also mentorship that really helped out. I've always been passionate about these issues, but most of my life never really did anything about them. But as I grew older in my late teens, I was just surrounded by really, really wonderful people who were doing this work. And one of them, his name is Justin. I remember we were having this conversation, and he was like, "Karina, you don't think you're a leader, do you?" And I just sat there and I wept. And just had and took that moment, and then afterwards just had a really, really good conversation on how I could really develop that and best move forward. So I would say he was very transformative in my leadership development, and yeah.
I feel for me, I felt that if you didn't make change, you couldn't expect everyone else to make change. So you couldn't expect a problem to just solve itself. You had to actually go out and do it. And I always thought if I didn't do it, no one else would. So that's what moved me forward.
Thank you, Suzette. I'm hearing a lot of you guys talking about mentors specifically, and I think one of the other questions I wanted to ask after hearing your answers is, how do we help cultivate this in other young people? If our goal is to create more young environmental leaders, what can we do? What can you do to help cultivate that?
Well, I think one of the big things is there has to be an emphasis on some sort of excitement. Otherwise, you're never going to bring anyone into the environmental movement. So personally, in my project, so I led 4 years of physical work, basically, so invasive species control, building a nature trail, installing storm drains for sewers so sewage doesn't run into the wastewater, into the reservoir. But I think one of the biggest things about the project was, you know, placing a key educational component that serves to, you know, kind of compound, you know, almost the gains that you get from doing an environmental project. And I don't think you're ever going to get anyone excited about it if you try to teach anything related to environmental conservation in a classroom. And I think you have to get the kids out there. You have to get them physically relating to what it is they're learning about. And, I mean, that's one of the easiest things to do considering the environment is all around us. So I think you have to have that like physical experience to bring people in and get excited about environmental conservation. Without that, I think it's just kind of, you know, there's no passion in it.
Thank you, Xerxes.
Xerxes. Yep.
There you go.
And I think specifically in regards to the mentorship component that you mentioned, it is absolutely necessary for people who are seeking mentors to open themselves up to that opportunity. And when you're expecting someone to open themselves up to you and to offer their experience and their guidance, then it's just the fundamental building block of that to say, here are my passions, here are my strengths, my weaknesses, my skills. You know, let's do something together and make this work.
Great. Thank you, Erica. All right. So one component that's pretty common on all of your projects is there's a social element as well as an environmental element. And I know in my experience, the environmental movement has a reputation for not being inclusive with racial or social problems. I'm wondering if any of you guys have encountered that sentiment, that sort of negative view of the environment or of the environmental movement. Anybody?
Well, especially in engineering, I don't know about it from an environmental perspective as much in the environmentalist movement, but especially in engineering, it's a very white male dominated field a lot of the time. And that can be kind of hard to punch through, but one of the things that our lab is most proud of is that we have a very diverse team of people from different races, different genders, different backgrounds entirely, and I think that's really helped us kind of fuel the passions for the environment within our lab. So, I mean, we all live on this earth. We all need to save the environment and make sure that we can maintain our resources. So I think it applies to everybody. So it's not, you know, this disclusivity is more of a localized thing rather than a global thing. I think overall the movement is very empowering to everybody if you implement it.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, back home in Tennessee, I definitely think environmentalism is commonly seen as a luxury. You know, it's a luxury to be able to go to Whole Foods and buy organic and local food. And it's, you know, an immense privilege to be able to afford a Prius and to not constantly guzzle gasoline as you drive around in the suburbs of Nashville. And so it's really our challenge and our prerogative to communicate that as environmentalists, we aren't fighting for people to be able to buy all their groceries at Whole Foods. We're fighting for victims of the Kingston coal ash spill that happened several years ago when a TVA plant leaked coal ash slurry into the Clinch River, and then the coal slurry was shipped to a predominantly black neighborhood in Alabama. And we have to communicate that we are fighting for the poor rural white folks in the Appalachian Mountains. And it's our responsibility as people who do initially have that privilege of identifying as an environmentalist to say, hey, it's so much more than that.
And just to go off that, I think it's common that sort of that negative sentiment of the environmental movement often comes from misinformation or from stereotypes. And yeah, I think it's important to sort of create a new name for environmentalism and conservation. And that was Erica. All right, next question. You guys are moving fast. All right, so this question is about your last week that you've spent together. What has this experience done for you, particularly if either if your project is ongoing or if you could go back and make changes? What specifically after this last week and this experience would you do differently?
Well, I don't know what necessarily yet I would do differently. Probably have to think about that more. But I think one of the big things is before coming to this award, you kind of the only relationship that exists between us was the profiles on the website, and it's almost kind of it's unique opportunity and experience to see those profiles come to life through these people that I'm sitting with here, and I think we all share the same experiences. It's almost as if, you know, we kind of do our projects and, you know, we see them sort of for what they are, but they're kind of in a vacuum in the sense that we're not thinking about, when I'm doing soil and water conservation, I'm not thinking of, you know, divestment efforts or, you know, law campaigns in Tennessee. So I think one of the very interesting things is that, you know, kind of before, I think I can speak for everyone, before we came here, what we saw as environmental action was through the lenses of our own eyes. And by seeing all these other people coming at it from different perspectives, it's almost, you know, it's interesting seeing how people, you know, approach, I mean, very broad topics that, you know, are so broad that you never think of the ways that people can, you know, take part in that. And I think it's really cool. I don't know, you guys, I know you were talking about, Will, engineering discipline, right?
Yeah.
You come at it with, you know, a very quantitative, you know, reasoning background, and I really love that too. You know, and I think, I know you could probably talk more about that. I think we definitely need more of that. And, you know, I don't know, all you guys too, we need law efforts. Like we were talking about earlier, we need top down and bottom up. So yeah, if anyone of you want to jump in, so I don't have to.
I think one of, oh, sorry, Heidi, you go.
I was just going to say, I think we could all agree with Xerxes. We were all kind of just thrown in together, barely knowing anything besides, oh, this person, like what projects they're working on. And I don't know what I would change in my project to be specific, but it's really interesting learning how to go through obstacles and get along when there's like so many different things going on with a new group of people.
I think one of the really cool things that I've learned this week, I never really considered myself part of the, well, I had considered myself part of the environmentalist movement. And then I went to college and in engineering, you kind of focused a little differently and focused more on the technical. But receiving this award and working with all these fantastic people up here has really made me think about how my work relates to the environmentalist movement and how I can help all of these people up here. I know, especially for me, in our lab, we don't think a lot about cultural sustainability. We think a lot about resource sustainability. And now, after being here, I'm really kind of more thought about the context of my work and how our work can be taken back and thought of in the context of people, not just things that we make.
Well, to follow up with that, I'm just curious if after, like, if you learned what you've learned this week before starting your project, maybe if you would have done outreach differently or engaged in different types of educational campaigns or anything like that?
I think, thank you for that question. It's a good question. I honestly, prior to this week, I would not have, firstly, I would not have thought of our outreach as essential as it actually is. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these people, you guys all work on some level of a social outreach part, and that has been part of our project, but I mean, it hasn't been as big of an aspect as I think it needs to be. So after meeting all of you and learning how you've done your outreach and seeing how you've done your projects, I think my team and I are going to go back and we're going to really be able to kind of sink our teeth into the ideas of more of the social justice aspect of this all, as well as being able to use what I've learned here from you guys about getting the word out to help increase our kind of our impact and better manage our campaigns as far as education goes. So thank you.
I think that this experience has sort of broadened all of our perspectives and showed us how different topics of environmentalism tie together, because even though what we each have done is it's really different, but we're all working towards a common goal, and I thought that was really unique.
Thank you, Suzette. Looks like we have a question from the audience. So what do we need to know from young social change makers, that's you guys, as we enter this upcoming election? Help us out, guys.
I think one really important thing to know about who you are going to vote for or elect is their stance on not only a project that you're working on, but other environmental issues going on. Right now, my project right now is in, I can't remember the word. In lawsuits, there's different lawsuits going on, and it's just been like pushback. So now it's not looking like we're going to get an answer in this current term. So whoever the next president is going to be really important on the next decision.
Thank you, Heidi. That was Heidi Kritz. Sorry, go ahead.
I will also say that, it's difficult, if not impossible, to put in place policies that harm youth and are detrimental to our future when the room is packed with young people and packed with voices that are there saying, this is our right. You know, we have a right to a healthy future, and we have a right to be able to succeed in what we want to do. And you all had your turn. but to say that, you know, we're here and we see you and we hear you and we know what you're doing and we're not okay with it. And to use our power as young people who can fight back and who don't want to take no for an answer when our future is on the line. I think there's a lot of power in that, and I think it's our responsibility to be plugged into these conversations and these decisions.
You can look at a lot of the policies that are discussed, especially at the debates. We watched the debate as a lab, actually. It was pretty funny. But when we were looking at that, the amount of frustration in the room, especially from a bunch of all the people up here, I'm so proud that everyone's so scientifically literate on this panel. This is awesome. Like, everyone is, like, fantastically knowledgeable. But the issue is the people trying to lead our country sometimes aren't as literate as the people up here as far as science goes. And so one of the things, you know, we kind of have to ask is that recently politicians are trying to distance themselves from very fact-based science. There's a lot of good studies out there that show a lot of the very hard facts about climate change and about what's going on with our planet. And yet there is this kind of environment of ignorance going on in a lot of places that just don't want it to be true. And one of the things that we talk about in our lab a lot is there used to be in our country sometimes an idea that we should do things not because they are easy, but because they are hard. And we no longer want to do that. We want to take the easiest route is to simply say climate change doesn't exist. We're not going to do anything about it. We're going to maintain the way we've been doing it for forever. But the hard thing is to take the problem and actually solve it, and to solve it without any remorse, and to solve it with just a fervor that is needed right now, because this problem is now. The problem is happening.
I definitely agree with Will that there's a sort of environmental ignorance. In my state, Florida, my governor actually said that he said that you weren't allowed to say the words climate change or sea level rise in his office. Therefore, yeah. So legislation regarding climate change and environmentalist movements isn't really moving forward right now within my state. And living in a really conservative part of Miami, I sort of see firsthand how a lot of people don't think that global warming is a thing. They think it's inevitable and that we're not really contributing to it. So, yeah, I think that the public needs to be more aware of the facts, and that's what you should keep in mind when voting this election.
Yeah, I think one of the important things, I'll keep it short and simple, but I think one of the important things to keep in mind is that certain issues, such as environmental conservation, our futures, should not be, you know, intimately tied to such bipartisan policies. I mean, the whole structure of our government is such that, you know, people can easily identify with one party or the other based on their beliefs. And if they have certain beliefs or if they don't have certain beliefs, I mean, those beliefs shouldn't affect our futures. And I think once you start, you know, muddling, taking this, like, nice mixed cocktail with you throwing Republicans, Democrats, and the environment in one room, it just doesn't go well because people are so drawn and aligned, magnetically aligned on party lines that they forget about the big picture. So if you could almost, like, if the government could separate sort of, you know, the EPA from all bipartisan politics, I think that'd be the best thing in the end. So I think, yeah, sometimes we get a little too caught up if, you know, you're Republican, you support Trump, you're Democrat, who do you support? I mean, it's, and at the end of the day, you lose sight of what you're actually fighting for.
I would like to add, just regardless of the results of our political chaos that we're currently enduring, as someone who has seen success working with environmental legislation in a very, very red state, I will say that bipartisan solutions can be possible and that there are aspects of the environmental movement that are for everybody, that appeal to everybody on a very human level. And so to just stay vigilant and to not give up that hope that there is common ground and that with a little negotiating and a little persistence and a whole lot of kindness, that those solutions can be found as well.
Thank you, Erica Davis. All right, one more question from our audience. And I'm interested in this answer also. You guys are all such a great group and seem to work really well together. Would you want to work together in the future? Do you have any plans to?
Not working with her. No. Well, I mean, first, the major part of it is that we've all, like, bounced the ideas we have off each other this whole week. Like, we're kind of confirming with each other that what we're doing is it matters to, I mean, it's always mattered to us as individuals, but does it matter to everybody else? And, you know, while that isn't always what we need to take to heart, I think it was really cool this week to see that what I did and what Erica did and Heidi did and Karina did and Suzette and Xerxes did all mattered to us. And we all wanted them all to succeed. I mean, in ways like I wanted to ship up just to Arizona right this weekend. Just be like, all right, let's go fight this thing. I'm ready to go. Because we're all very inspired by each other and by the networks we're creating right now. I mean, this is kind of a very cool thing to be a part of. And I know I'm going to be working with all these people as we go forward to kind of help their movements. And they'll help our, you know, our work in the lab. And I think it's going to be very exciting over the next few years here.
Before I met these folks, I definitely would not have thought that I would want to continue working with them, only because our projects and what we're working on is so completely different, which I'm sure was on purpose. But having been with them for only a week, aside from just bonding a lot and getting along really, really well, the fact that the things we are working on are so different and we get at the same issues from completely different angles is so helpful in thinking things through that I would love to continue working with these people.
I definitely agree with Karina. I really want to emphasize what she said about seeing the same issues from different angles, and that's what I was trying to get at earlier when I was saying that it working with everyone this week has broadened my perspective. Because you're able to see how all the issues are connected in really similar ways and how even though all the work that we do is so different and we come from such different backgrounds and we're such different people, we're all working towards the same goals. And it's just really helped us bond. And I really see myself working with these people in the future.
Thank you, Suzette. All right. I have another question. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Sorry, just had to confirm. I was just going to say it was really fun spending the week and camping and going to different parts of California I've never been to, but while we were camping on one of our hiking trips, we got to see redwood trees, and for some of us, it was our first time. Some see them all the time, but I just, listening to what everyone had to say about wanting to work together, we all thought it was super cool how they're all connected under in the roots. So each tree, so I'm happy to have everyone connected.
Thank you, Heidi. So looking at you, there seems to be a bit of an imbalance as far as gender. It's a little bit surprising to me, because I think sort of the environmental movement that I know seems to be male dominated. I'm wondering if this is something that you guys have noticed yourselves or talked about.
To be honest, I didn't think about gender one time the whole week. No. I mean, it's just so amazing because, like, you know, sometimes you if you zoom out and look at it, it's such a different, you know, kind of, you see so many different things. And if you're actually, like, in the mix, breathing, living, same thing. So I didn't think, like, I think we really see each other as people more than, you know, you're a woman fighting for this rather than just you're fighting for this. And I think that's one of the great things that I hope I can speak for everyone. The idea of, like, a gender imbalance didn't really cross my mind this whole trip, and I think that's a really positive thing. So, I don't think we really notice it that much.
I was a sociology major in undergrad, and in a lot of my more theory-based classes, we studied how environmentalism is traditionally associated with feminine stereotypes and maternal instincts, and that it is the role of a woman to care about the planet while men worry about other things or real issues. And so I've actually been really thrilled to see the presence of men in the environmental movement. And I was also shocked that when I went to the first environmental law organization meeting at my law school, that I was one of the only women in the room. So it's interesting. There may be a geographic difference in who is present in these conversations. But I am pretty pleased that some of those older, more antiquated stereotypes of who an environmentalist is and should be are kind of being torn down.
Yeah, and I think there should always be a balance in the sense that sometimes we might get a little too carried away with artificially boosting numbers here or there. Like, you might see at a college, like, oh, they have 51% women. Next year they have to get more men in. And I think one of the great threats to any, like, organization or any, you know, anything, you're talking about engineering, is that you should strive. You're talking about engineering earlier and, like, the imbalance between men and women. I think you should strive to get a natural balance in the sense that sometimes there can be, like, an overemphasis on we need to get these cold, hard numbers, and there's just no human aspect in it. And I think you should, you know, there's a difference between, like, you know, hindering someone from an opportunity versus artificially, like, I don't want to say disturbing the flux, but I think there should always be some, like, human element into it instead of just looking things at, like, in terms of cold, hard numbers rather than what they are.
I think one of the most important things this week that we, yeah, why we didn't notice this is we're all up here because of merit.
Right.
That's how I think we should always look at an organization or anything we do.
Exactly.
We're all up here because we work our butts off, mm-hmm, and we work really hard to do the things that we do. But that also means we do need to create equal space. There is, mm-hmm, points where, like, well, you said, yeah, there's don't boost the numbers artificially, but there's also places where it's artificially skewed.
Oh,
because,
yeah, no,
right,
totally
exactly.
Agree.
No,
I'm saying, yeah, you shouldn't hinder people. You should get everyone the same opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that's definitely, yeah, big
no, but that's exactly, that's the beauty of all of what we do, mm-hmm, is it has to be merit-based.
Mm-hmm.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the 17th Annual Brower Youth Awards. This year's award winners are, and you're hearing from them now, thank you. Suzette Onate, Karina Gonzalez, Heidi Kritz, Erica Davis, and Will Amos. And our moderator is Rosemary Brower Olson, granddaughter of David Brower. And back to you, Rosemary.
Thank you. Here's another question from the audience. What are some of the ways that you feel you have most grown as a leader since you've gotten involved in environmental work?
Well, I think one of the big things that I think of when I think of leadership is the power of inspiration. And I think one of the great things about environmental conservation is that you're never going to get anyone to work towards a common goal by monetary gain. I mean, the people you have working for this kind of stuff, as we can all say, they're the people who actually care about the issues they're fighting for. And one of the big things about leadership is, you know, I mean, you hear about companies going under all the time, they're replacing management, this and that. But if you truly have people who all are working towards the same vision and see that vision, even though it might not be real, I think that's really where leadership comes in. I think we can all attest to the fact that one of the great challenges about environmental conservation is basically the only one of the big methods of attack you have is you have to find people who deeply care about the same issues, and you're never going to get sort of people artificially, you know, coming this far. You're never going to get people who are artificially, you know, really involved in it. So I think that's one of the, it really tests your leadership skills if you can get people who, you know, play the same tune as you. I don't know what you think. Well, you look like you want to say something.
No, I'm just leaning over to look at
you. Okay.
I feel that after being involved with the environmentalist movement, it's taught me how important passion is when being a leader. You can't really lead a group towards something that you're not passionate about, because they won't want to work with the same motivation as they would if they see passion when you speak. So, yeah, it's just passion. You can't really lead something that you don't believe in successfully.
For me personally, it was just confidence in my own abilities, and a lot of that came from breaking the rules and throwing out the instruction manual and just diving into things if I didn't necessarily know how they were going to turn out, and having that actually work out and just being impressed by what I did, that helped.
Thank you, Karina.
As a leader, I think one of the things that I gained is confidence in using my voice, no matter how hard it is for me to talk about something or how nervous I am to go in front of a group. I'm able to know that I am using my voice for a good cause, and even though it just makes the smallest wave, I am able to grow as a leader still.
I've learned a lot about leadership. One of the most important things that I've learned, though, is that you're no leader at all unless you have people who are looking to you for support and who are also supporting you in that position. I've also learned that it's a really important experience and possibly an indicator that you're leading the right way. If you're a little uncomfortable with that role, I know in the work that I do, I get asked questions and get asked to do things for people, and I often wonder, like, why is this my responsibility? I don't know anything. Like, I don't know more than these people. I'm not better at this than anybody. I'm just here in this position using my passion, as Suzette said, and using my time and my youthful energy and, you know, the network of people that I've built up in different leadership positions to create change and work toward a common goal. So I think thinking about leadership in that way is really humbling and kind of brings you back down to earth a little in that position.
Thank you.
One of the main goals main things that I've really come to learn is that when you show your cards, show your passion to everyone on your team, you can really get people riled up and ready to go, especially if they share a similar passion. Before, when I was learning when I was doing my engineering classes, a lot of our group projects, and when I worked in the industry as an engineering intern, it was kind of like the leaders always seemed very stoic, and that was their goal, was to like never show their cards. They always were supposed to seem like very logical, very level human beings, and they were just never supposed to kind of really show what they were why they loved doing what they do. But for me, what I've learned through being a little more into the environmental movement so far is that you really have to show people how much you love to work. And sometimes that means you're working a lot more than the people on your team, but that's okay. Like, you are going to be the person with the most passion on it every time. And I think it's great that I've learned over the course of this last year and a half with our lab that, you know, it's okay if I'm being very passionate about it, because that helps bring people in and helps grow your network of people following you.
Thank you, Will. So this is called the Brower Youth Awards. What do you feel like as a young person under the age of 23? Is that what the cutoff is? What do you feel that you contribute that someone older maybe couldn't? Or why is it so important to encourage young people in the environmental movement?
I feel it's really important to encourage young people to join the environmental movement, because we're getting to this point where we're going to be the policymakers. We're going to be the ones that I think this is one of the first elections where the most amount of millennials can vote. We're the ones that are casting votes now. We're the ones that can make change happen. And we have a lot of energy, and I think that it needs to be put in the right places.
As a young leader, I think it is important for other young people to know where we are today and how we got there. Like in Alaska, we have all these hunting and fishing rights, and it's really important for them to know why it is what it is, so they could protect it and keep living the way they want to live, whether it's subsistence or just traditional practices.
One of the main objectives of all of our work as youth leaders is kind of helping new leaders come up into this, you know, knowing that their opinion is valued. That's, I think, one of the things that really has helped us all this week, is we've kind of had our opinion and our official opinion valued by more people than just those within our group. They've been kind of validated by those around us, and that's not necessary. You know, there will be moments where we, you know, our opinions maybe aren't always validated, but the idea is that as a youth member of the environmental movement, we can kind of see what the others have done in front of us and kind of really take a lessons learned perspective on it and see what they've done and what has worked and what hasn't. And we can kind of take that forward into our own experiences. And I think that's something that we can uniquely do.
I also think as youth, we have this really unique sense of urgency, because we have a lot of life left in front of us. And to think that we may have to live with the consequences of environmental inaction for decades is terrifying. And to think that in our lifetimes, we may never get the chance to experience the Great Barrier Reef before it dies, or to see snow on mountains that have always been covered in snow, or to hear stories about Pacific Islanders displaced because their homes are completely underwater. It's urgent, and we have to do something now, because this is what we will live through. And these are the cards we got dealt. And so it's kind of our requirement.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, Erica. And I think the reason why we have such a strong sense of urgency is because we are the ones that are going to inherit this planet. We are the ones that are going to also inherit the problems that your generation, sorry, but it's too, created. And therefore, we have more of a right and more of, and should have more of a say in how to solve those problems. And I also just want to take the moment to note that we got these cool pins that say tomorrow's leaders, but we're today's leaders.
Nice.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Hey.
All right, so I thought someone was going to say something. All right, how about another question from one of our audience members? Here's how can I or others here today and those listening to the broadcast learn more about your award-winning work and support your efforts?
So if I'm not the official spokesman of the Brower Youth Awards, but you can find us on browereryouthawards.org. Is that it? We have our profiles up, and there's some bios. There'll be videos up shortly. So that's mainly, I guess, where people could learn about it. I know Anisha would know more about that. And then there's a ceremony tomorrow night at the Herbst Theater.
And if you want to support us individually, you can contact them through their website, and they will put you in touch with us.
I guess for more specific answers, for my project, Protecting Bristol Bay, I work for United Tribes of Bristol Bay, and we have take action items on our website. You can find it at www.utbb.org and just click the Take Action tab and sign one of our letters to a decision maker.
Thank you. So I think you guys have had the opportunity to learn a little bit about my grandfather, David Brower. I just sort of wanted to, I'm curious to see what what you think, if he were alive today, he would be most concerned about or most eager to change, or also just if there's anything that you've connected with particularly about his story or him as a person.
I think for me, growing up in Marin County, which is very close to where he lived as a young person in Berkeley, California. I kind of fell in love with similar parts of nature as him. I feel like my process was kind of similar. He went into the Sierra a lot, and that's where he kind of really fell in love with the natural world around him. And I did a similar process through Boy Scouts and things. Not to compare myself at all to David Brower. He's way cooler than I am at this point. But the whole idea of going into nature to understand it and then bring the information you learn back out was a big part of what I took away from knowing a little bit about his story, as well as taking action first and then apologizing if necessary later.
For me, I think he would be very interested in how much of a diverse of a group we are, because we come from all over the U.S. and we're all have different culture backgrounds. One thing that really stood out to me on the Brower website is a quote by David Brower. I might be a few words off, but it's, "We don't inherit the earth, we only borrow it from our children." And where I come from, that's why we respect the land and animals and really take care of it, because that is what gives us life.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the 17th Annual Brower Youth Awards. And we've come to that program, a part in our program where we're coming close to the end. And it's always been really wonderful to have all of you come and speak with us and share with us. And the other thing I'd like to share with you is that I get to ask the last questions. So we'll start out with Will and Will Amos, and we'll go down. And my first question for you, this really is your century, and we really depend on you. And so what has been is most important for each of you, and I'll ask each of you the same question, what is most important for you to do during this century to make changes? So, Will, let's start with you.
Hopefully change the infrastructure of our country and world. We have a lot of population growth going on, and we have a lot of new infrastructure that needs to be implemented. Our old infrastructure is aging out right now, and there's theories in the air that we should replace it with the same stuff that we put in there 50 years ago. That would be a basically fatal mistake if we did that as a world. We need to make sure that it's updated to sustainable resource use, and that it is, because that will help stem or hopefully stop the problem of global climate change.
Erica Davis from Tennessee. By the way, Will Amos is from California. And now we're at Erica Davis from Tennessee.
So I feel most strongly that my purpose and my calling as a part of this century, for as long as I'm here, is to be a tool for the environmental movement in the Southeast United States and to learn from what has been accomplished by the environmental movement in other areas, learn from my peers on this panel, from their experiences, their struggles, their successes, and to bring what I've learned back to my home where I have the I live there. I have the cultural competency to organize and to work there. And I have the experience that it takes to work in a place where it's very difficult to accomplish environmental successes. And it's exhausting and it is heartbreaking. But when you do make a tiny step forward, when you get one step closer to your goal, it's the most rewarding experience. And I can't even explain it. So that's my personal prerogative in this very trying time. As for other people who are maybe not millennials and who are depending on us, as you said in your question, give us the space and the trust to do the work that we are excited to do and that we are equipped to do and that we are ready to keep doing as long as it's necessary until we ultimately win.
And Heidi Kritz from Alaska.
I think it's really important to let the younger people know how important their voice is. Because they are the future and we won't be here, but they will and their kids will and so on. So I think it's really important for them to know that their voice matters and they could make a change if they really want to.
Karina Gonzalez.
Thank you. What is most important to me is to develop as much leadership as possible, especially as someone who works on student campaigns. There is so much turnover that really developing that leadership is particularly crucial within those campaigns.
Okay. Suzette Onete.
I feel like habitat destruction and conservation is very important, and it's pretty much connected to all the environmental issues that we're currently facing. Right now, I feel like young people need to understand, as Heidi said, that they have a voice and that if they want to make a difference, they can. They have the power to do so. And we need to take action and change our... We need to take action and put forth our voice and make sure that we have elected officials that advocate for what we believe in so that we can accomplish all the things that we want to accomplish.
And Xerxes Liebers?
I think one of the big things that I would like to see in our generation is, we look at, the current tides, and I know Will would definitely like this. And one of the things, in today's day and age, the people who are changing the world are, you look at Bill Gates, you look at Steve Jobs, you look at Jack Dorsey, you look at all these people, and they always have some role with technology. Elon Musk is a great example. And I think one of the big things that you know, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of people in the environmental movement, I mean, in any movement are missing out on is, you know, being able to harness some new technology that's, you know, we never know what's going to come next. But just putting more dollars towards, you know, finding that new technology that could have broad impacts on any range of, you know, environmental problems. And I think, you know, it's kind of hard to put a number on because, you know, those technologies don't exist right now. But I think that's why it's so important to develop them at the end of the day. And, you know, we kind of almost need a lifeline as it is. And we're going to keep trying. And I think just putting more dollars towards research efforts in specifically tailored to environmental, solving environmental crises. I think that's one of the big things I like to see happen.
And following up on that, Will Hummels, what do you see as your biggest challenge to the environment?
Convincing a decades-old system that it needs to change. That's definitely the biggest problem we're going to face. Aldrin and I, as co-managers of the lab, have already, I mean, we've barely gotten off the ground and we've already faced pushback in what we would like to do to change things. So it's going to be an uphill battle, but we're going to keep fighting it. And I think that the biggest challenge will be just trying to get people to realize that things cannot continue the way they have always been. They think, you know, people think that things have worked the last 100 years, they may as well work the next 100 years. That is not how the environment works. So we have to change that mindset.
And as I mentioned before, Will is from California. Erica Davis from Tennessee.
Kind of along those lines, I think one of the biggest challenges we face in the environmental movement is that there is no profit in changing business as usual. The people who are benefiting from business as usual have a vested interest in it, and there's a lot at stake for them. And also along those lines, I think a challenge is changing the way we think, the way we operate, and scaling that up, because individual actions aren't enough to solve our planetary crisis. We need to look at the way we build our cities, and we need to look at the way we develop on a global scale, which is huge. And that's a bigger challenge than any one person has the ability to contemplate or to even think about solving alone. And so kind of beginning to work together, like, you know, it can start with six really different people with really different interests and think about how to scale up changing business as usual to a much larger, broader impact.
And Heidi Kritz from Alaska.
One of the biggest challenges in my project is because it's been going on for so long, people who already know about it think that it's just over and it's not a problem anymore, but we're still fighting to protect Bristol Bay. Another one is that getting it out that what I'm trying to protect is more than just the environment. It's my way of life. It's how I've lived for 21 years and multiple generations before me. And I'm doing it for the environment, but I want my children and my grandchildren to be able to go down the beach and get a fish from the beach at my grandma's house and to be able to bring it up and process it for the winter. I want the people, the future people, to be able to live the same way I did, if not even more, in a more thriving culture and traditions.
And Karina Gonzalez from Arizona.
Yes. The biggest challenge our movement faces is the invested interest of the fossil fuel industry in our political system. Sorry for getting really political, but it's true. And I completely lost my train of thought. But they're basically pushing a 200-year-old mentality that says we, like Erica said, need to continue business as usual. I mean, we have what we need. We have the technology. We just need the political will to change.
And Suzanne Onate from Florida.
I definitely agree with everything that all of these folks have had to say, but I really want to emphasize what Will said about convincing older people that this is important, because that's the issue that I've faced, and that's a challenge that I've faced within my project. I had to work within a high school bureaucracy, and I got all the kids to care about the butterfly garden that I helped restore, but none of the administration cares about it. Very few teachers care about it. Only like the science department cared about it. I've been trying to expand the butterfly garden to one of the county parks that are nearby, and it's been such a hassle because everyone that I contact in the city is just like, oh no, contact this other person. And I just keep getting pushed to the side, and none of the adults seem to care that habitat destruction is an actual issue, and environmental movements are real and they need to keep moving forward. So I think convincing older people and the people that are in power right now is the most pressing issue at the moment.
And Zerky Liebrich from New York.
I think I'll take the flip side of that coin, and I'll say for me the challenge is not so much about convincing an older generation of to do something otherwise, but rather convincing a new generation to stay in tune with what we're doing. And I think it's so much more important because, I mean, at the end of the day, if we sit here and say, you know, we want to convince a new generation, then in 50 years, our generation is exactly like the generation before us, I think we've fundamentally failed. And I think we should be focusing on, you know, the untapped potential instead of, you know, old archaic systems. And I think that's one of the challenges I think we face, just getting people to tap into that same energy that we all create right here, the six of us between us on in this panel. That's for me.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. And our program, the 17th Annual Brower Youth Awards. We want to thank everyone who's here for their participation, and especially a big thank you to our winners, our 2016 winners. Congratulations to each of you. And to our wonderful moderator, Rosemary Brower Olson. And, you know, we've been very, very lucky to have with us all of this time helping us down the road, Isha Dazari. And she's been a wonderful help with us here at the Commonwealth Club, and I know she's been a wonderful person to guide you through this week and all your work. And also we want to thank our wonderful audience that's here and on the radio and the Internet. We really appreciate your listening to us. You can find our environmental programs on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on Watch and Listen. And mark your calendars for our upcoming events. October 26th, Tom Steemstra is going to talk about his adventures, starting with the mighty Tuolumne River, starting in the Yosemite Glaciers to the Golden Gate Bridge. This is a very special evening to us here in San Francisco because we are part of the whole mighty Tuolumne River that has given us water and has come from our own Yosemite Glaciers. November 10th, Rick Hansen, another wonderful program, A Curious Brain Not Manipulated by Needless Fear. November 16th, a holiday toast to the 2016 wine harvest. Some of you a little bit too young for the wine harvest, but this is from the California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance, and this is also a fun holiday night. And finally, on December 1st, Resilience. This is a new documentary by James Redford, and it's a story about children, hope, research, and the environment. And I want to add on to that your talk tonight, which really does emphasize both the present and the future and how much we need to work for the present now and a good future in the 21st century. Thank you for being with us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.